This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our week in review program. We live in a crazy world, would you not agree? So much important news is happening, so much that is really of prophetic significance, and a lot of what we've covered this week on thetrumpet.com and what we've covered on the radio this week at kpcg.fm, it's extremely important. There's a lot to cover. We've got a lot to discuss, and really, I'm very excited about the program today. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. We have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Robert Morley.
Hi.
And via Skype from our office in the UK, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Our top story today is the immigration crisis in Europe. And we're going to hit this story from a number of different angles today. It's a huge story, and it's getting bigger and bigger with enormous prophetic implications. Brad McDonald has a terrific story on thetrumpet.com today called Europe's Intractable Problem. I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to read that article on thetrumpet.com. Basically, the overview of the situation is the Middle East is absolutely on fire. There's massive unrest in several Middle Eastern countries. You've got civil war raging in Syria, terrorism in Iraq and Eritrea and Libya, these areas in the Middle East where you have the Islamic State rampaging through. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are being displaced. And what are they doing? They're, so many of them, heading to Europe. They're doing whatever they need to do to try to get to safety. They're taking boats and trains and cars and vans and finding ways to smuggle into European nations. A lot of these European nations are dealing with a flood of immigration. Germany is taking in the most. By reports, they could take in as many as 800,000 refugees and migrants just this year alone. 800,000 people flooding into Germany. Now, this is obviously creating serious problems in several European nations. It's creating a lot of social disruption. And then there's a lot of economic implications, massive strain on social services, public services, huge economic costs. But then there's also the cultural strains and the problems that happen when you have this many people from the Middle East coming into Europe, and a lot of people in Europe that are concerned about all of these foreigners. You have a lot of attacks on hostels and the places where the immigrants are staying. And this article by Brad McDonald asks the question, how in the world do you solve this problem? What's the solution? I mean, the tragedy of what's happening in these Middle Eastern countries is very real. It's very serious. And, you know, looking at the overarching solution, the real solution is, well, fix these Middle Eastern nations, end the war in Syria, bring stability to these areas where all of these people are being displaced. I'll just read a statement from his article here. He says, give these poor people a reason to stay home. Make sure they have food and clean water, a safe home and stable community, a healthy economy. They also need hope, the lack of which is a huge part of why they are currently fleeing. Physical well-being and hope, that's all these people want. That's what we all want. No problem, right? Just solve the Middle East. Here's another quote from the article. How to fix Syria? Simply end the civil war. But this means tackling Bashar Assad, a powerful, heartless man with even more powerful, heartless friends. Taking out Assad would require force and fortitude, both of which the West lacks. Confronting Assad in a meaningful way would likely mean conflict with Iran and Russia, probably China too. Such conflict would engulf the Middle East. It would be World War III. This is a huge, huge issue. What are the chances of actually repairing the damage in the Middle East to stop this flood of migrants? It's very unlikely to happen. So, okay, what's the alternative? Is Europe supposed to just allow this flood of immigrants to come in. Europeans are getting less and less willing to do that. Just a couple more quick quotes from this article. This crisis, as every crisis does to one degree or another, exposes the inadequacy of the human mind to solve problems at their most fundamental level. You know, this is something that a lot of people can look at and say, this really does need solutions, but there really are no solutions that present themselves that would be easy. They're all very, very difficult, very costly, and some of them would lead to conflict on a scale that we're not really willing to go to. Here's a one last quote. Honestly, I think most people haven't yet fully comprehended how serious, how perilous, how incurable this crisis is. Right now, there's a lot of emotion and not enough serious thought and understanding. That spells disaster. The understanding will come, but it will come too late. It will come after Europe is on fire. It seems like the scale of this problem has just kind of exploded over the last few months, and it's really presenting the possibility of there being serious, serious implications for Europe, for the Middle East, and for the world. I want to just turn now to Richard and talk about the situation as it's developing in Germany and some of these European nations that are trying to address and to grapple with the scope of the problem. Can you fill us in, Richard?
Today, everything is immigration. That's what the EU President Donald Tusk said on Thursday. And it really has dominated the news this week. Just in putting together the Trumpet Weekly, you know, immigration is very important, but to try and include some variety, I was looking for some news stories that weren't just about immigration. And really, this is the main and almost the only big story going on in Europe right now. It is huge, and it is completely dominating all of the articles. And that was one of the great things about Mr. McDonald's article, is it does highlight the scale of what Europe is facing right now.
Within Germany, there was this really strong article from Spiegel that gives us an idea of which way is Germany going to break. It could be good, it could be really catastrophic.
Yes, and I think you see not just Germany, a whole lot of Europe is on this tipping point. And that's I do like the way this Spiegel article contrasts those two approaches. And I don't want, you know, we know where Europe is going from Bible prophecy, and we know that it is going into the more authoritarian direction. But I think it's still important to not kind of mischaracterize or mispaint the reaction in Germany. And Spiegel does make some good points. Germans seem more willing to help than ever before. 60% have said that they want to welcome these more immigrants in, and there's been an outpouring of people donating to immigrants and donating to refugee shelters, and they've had so many volunteers and people turning out to give to these places that they've not been able to accommodate them.
It truly is people recognizing that the tragedy in the Middle East, that these people really do need help.
Right.
But then you have this other trend within Germany and these other nations. And just tell us about that part.
And we can't gloss over that either. No, is that there's, 199 attacks on refugee hostels by July 6th. That's not even including the last month, which has probably been the worst month for this of the whole year. So that's a huge level of attacks on refugee shelters.
Can you give us an idea of what's happening in these attacks?
Yeah, there have been some arson attacks. There was an attack just yesterday where some refugees were staying that got burnt down. They're not sure, because again, a lot of these refugees are being cramped into unsafe quarters, so then they haven't determined in this particular case whether it was arson or whether it was an accident. But there are clear examples of arson. There was about a month ago, a prominent left-wing politician in Germany who's been very outspokenly pro-immigration. His car was completely burnt. He wasn't in it at the time, so he was attacked.
So really some quite violent responses from some contingent within the German population against these immigrants.
And when German Chancellor Angela Merkel travels to some of these areas that are most affected by immigrants, she is going there with very solid military protection against angry crowds.
She's been the biggest proponent of trying to accommodate as many immigrants as possible. So you've got Germans that are saying, well, go ahead.
Well, not the biggest. She has been a big one. She is actually taking some flack from the other side as well for not speaking out sooner. And there are people on the left, because remember, she's a center-right politician. So there are left-wing politicians that have been even more pro-immigration. But she certainly has been very solidly in favor and made some dramatic moves to help immigrants.
Enough to the point where she has Germans who are basically yelling in her face that she's a traitor to her country.
Yes. And then what I think is a sign of what's to come for Germany is have a look at the countries that are most against immigration. And it's the ones that have been affected the most. You know, Germany may be taking in more immigrants than any other country or any other single country, but they're not on the front lines of the immigration crisis. It's not like Greece or like Italy or Bulgaria, where you've got hundreds of thousands in some of those cases coming through the country in a year. And fine, they may not be staying there, but they're still causing a lot of problems there. And Germany hasn't been on the front lines in the same way. But it's these frontline countries that have acted in the more authoritarian. It's, again, I don't want to characterize it as necessarily a bad thing. I'm not, I don't want to condemn some of the statements, because a lot of the things that these right-wing countries are doing are just common sense. Like Mr. McDonald's article brought out, there are no good solutions here. But the more authoritarian countries are the ones that have been hit the hardest. And so as Germany gets hit more and more of these 800,000 that are going to cross into Germany get here, those other countries on the periphery, like Hungary, give us a good indication of what's going to come to Germany.
So what sort of rhetoric are we seeing out of Hungary, out of the Czech Republic, and some of these other nations?
Well, here's a very interesting quote from Hungary's prime minister. He said, those arriving have been raised in another religion and represent a radically different culture. Most of them are not Christians but Muslims. This is an important question because Europe and European identity is rooted in Christianity. Is it not worrying in itself that European Christianity is now barely able to keep Europe Christian? There is no alternative and we have no option but to defend our borders. And he's building a big razor wire fence. Also in Hungary, there have been, the reports are still a little conflicting, but Muslims or immigrants have packed themselves into trains thinking that it's going to take them across the border, and the trains have instead taken them to immigration camps, and there's an ongoing standoff with police at one of these stations now because they're trying to force the immigrants into one of these camps. There's 500 of them. They don't want to go. In Poland or in the Czech Republic, there was reports of police officers showing up and stamping registration numbers on the arms of refugees and dragging them off trains. So there is a lot more authoritarian response in some of those countries.
I find it interesting. I just want to throw this out there to hear a prime minister saying this is a Christian country or this is a Christian continent and we don't want them bringing their religion in here. We're obviously facing our immigration problem here in the United States, but you don't hear religion being brought into the picture. I'm trying to imagine a United States politician saying, we don't want these immigrants because we're a Christian nation. But here in Europe, you actually have this religious component to the equation that is pretty unique.
That is a big difference, isn't it? America was founded on the ideals of freedom of religion. People come here, they're able to practice the religion they want. Europe's very different. We just saw last week as well, Richard, I'm sure you heard that Slovakia, their prime minister came out and said, yes, we're willing to accept immigrants, but we want them from Christian countries. We don't want them from the Muslim countries. So this is something that is starting to come to the forefront. You probably saw those horrifying images this week out of the little boy that washed up on shore in Europe. I think it was in Italy, somewhere in Italy, on the shore, just a little baby. I looked at him and he looked exactly like my son. The body of him looked like my son. He could have been my boy. And I'm sure there's millions of other Europeans looking at, pictures like this, looking at the pictures we saw this week, those dramatic images of the mother and the baby and the father being dragged off the train tracks by the police, and images of World War II and the lead up to World War II are flashing on people's minds. all across Europe. But at the same time, as you said, Richard, this is a huge problem. To me, the most interesting thing is that how Europe is looking to Germany for solutions again. Here, once again, Europe recognizes that if there's going to be a solution, it has to come from Germany. Armstrong International Cultural Foundation marketing director Shane Granger was recently over in Turkey, and I was talking to him about this the other day, and he saw this firsthand, and he said that all the immigrants he talked to, all the refugees that he talked to, the message was the same. We're heading to Germany. We're heading to Germany. We're going to Germany. Germany is seen as like their salvation to all these. Word is out that if you want to get somewhere to have a better life, you need to go to Germany. And the rest of the European nations are seeing this, and they're saying Germany has to be part of the solution if we are going to stop this. And we are seeing it. As you said in the past, Richard, Europeans are now, we have an article up on the website talking about how Europeans are now becoming proactive and are intercepting smuggler ships in international waters. They're now sinking ships in international waters, destroying vessels that are being used to bring migrants to Europe, because they say we have to confront this issue at its source. And the next stage that politicians are talking about is actually going into North Africa to help solve the problem in North Africa, whatever those solutions may be.
I could jump in on that religion point as well. I did see an article this morning that is a really, it's really fascinating. It's a report about Muslims in, it was from Associated Press, Muslims in Germany converting to Christianity in droves. And what it is under European human rights law, you can't be, if you're an asylum seeker or anybody, you can't be sent home to a country where you face the death penalty. If you're a Muslim refugee and your country is a Muslim country, the at home, the penalty for converting to Christianity is death. So there's now this new trend of Muslims converting to Christianity because once they're Christian, they can't be sent home anymore because they'd face the death penalty back home. And I'm sure Europe didn't plan this out and do this to try and
as a means of converting people.
But it's a really fascinating unintended consequence of that. And it's just an interesting aspect to that religious dimension.
This whole story just resonates because of so many strands of prophecy that we have our eyes on. And this inevitable conflict between the Muslim Middle East and Catholic Europe, and just the strain and the pressure that this is putting on this relationship, and the tension between these two entities is growing and becoming like epic. And at the same time, the anger and the animosity within European nations, and like you said, images of World War II. I mean, the history of Europe with respect to these kinds of questions, you just can't help but bring that history to mind as you're watching this unfold. And this, I mean, even the religious nature of the wars and the crusades and the clash of civilizations that we've seen between these two entities, it's all coming to the forefront. And it's projecting right into some of the most significant prophecies that we expect to happen here. We're kind of seeing these easily, how these things could explode into exactly what we've been talking about in terms of another much more catastrophic clash. Well, Richard, before we conclude this first segment, can you give us the overview of any other news? You said everything was about immigration this week, but did you find anything else that you feel like would be worth sharing?
Well, one thing is a lot of countries have been very critical of Britain this week because in some ways this isn't Britain's problem. Britain has stayed out of the Schengen zone that allows people to move freely. And Britain has said that they're not going to accept any more immigrants. And so that's made quite a few people unhappy. And they said, well, that's going to affect the renegotiation about Britain's place in the EU. So another strand of this immigration crisis is that it is pushing Britain further away from the rest of Europe. Then another unrelated piece of news is the Pope this week said that all priests can forgive women for having abortion. And that's not really a big change. Oh, and that's only for the next year. But that's not really a big change for the Catholic Church. There's only a few dioceses that a normal priest can't forgive this. But it is a big PR coup, and it's gotten the Catholic Church a lot of headlines, and they look very sympathetic and liberal in the media. So it's been a good PR week for them. And the EU has extended some sanctions on Russia until spring 2016, which was pretty expected.
All right. Thank you, Richard. The stories that we've been talking about, there are several stories about immigration. We're going to talk about this more coming up after the break. We're going to talk about Russia's involvement in the Islamic State and the cause of many of these refugees. But these articles can be found in the Trumpet Weekly. This is a report that we produce every week with the most significant stories from around the world. And I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free report. If you go online to thetrumpet.com, you can become a subscriber to the Trumpet Weekly. It's just an excellent, highly informative report. Coming up next, some more discussion about other aspects of the refugee crisis. And we'll also have important news from Asia and the Middle East and America. And later on in the program, our lightning round of headlines from all of our panelists. Our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're going to go now to Jeremiah Jacques, and we'll start with the overview of headlines from Asia.
Sure. Yes, the Philippines on Monday asked for U.S. military assistance in the South China Sea to counter China's ongoing expansion there. And the U.S. basically told the Philippines that despite the fact that they are a staunch U.S. ally, Manila is basically on its own and America does not want to get involved in the conflict. And then Russia and China, according to an article in the L.A. Times, are both using hacked data to target U.S. spies. We've heard a lot about these massive hacks by Russian and Chinese cyber spies. And now we see what these nations are doing with all of that confidential information that they've stolen from us. One quote from this article says, "Foreign spy services in China and Russia are aggressively aggregating and cross-indexing hacked U.S. computer databases to identify U.S. intelligence officers and agents." So basically, they're figuring out who America's spies are. And then they're tracking them, and in some cases, even blackmailing and trying to recruit them. So the Trumpet has been warning about America's vulnerability to cyber attacks for almost 20 years now. And now with reports like this, you can really see that those warnings were well-founded.
We were talking about just how dangerous China getting hold of all of this information would be, and it makes very mild response, or really non-response, from America to these cyber attacks that much more concerning. So the top story from Asia, in your view this week, Jeremiah?
The top story ties in very well to what we were discussing in the first segment, and that is that Russia has put boots on the ground in Syria. This is a very significant development. I think most people know that what's happening in that Syrian conflict is basically a lot of various Sunni Islam groups, including the Islamic State, are trying to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad, who is Shia, a Shia Muslim, represents about 10% of the Syrian population. And on the Trumpet Hour, we've discussed this tragic ongoing war several times, but normally from a Middle Eastern perspective. What does this mean for Iran? What does this mean for, you know, various Arab states and so on? But Russia has a lot at stake in this war. Assad has allowed Russia to operate a major naval base there in Tartus. It's right on the Mediterranean. And Assad has also allowed Russia to build some major military operations in Latakia, which is Syria's most important port, and elsewhere in the country. And so Syria, as it is now, ruled by Assad, is incredibly valuable to Russia. It's the number one conduit through which Russia can project power into the Middle East. And the Russians know that if Assad were to be toppled by the Sunnis, then it would very unlikely remain aligned with Russian interests. It would be very unlikely that Syria would continue to host these Russian military bases. And so for that reason, Russia is fighting to maintain the status quo. It wants to keep its ally, Assad, in power. And so Russia's presence in the war has been ongoing in a very small scale since the beginning of the war, but suddenly, just this week, Russia's participation in the war has sharply escalated, and now reports even say that Russian troops have embedded themselves with the Syrian army. One report from Ynet has even said that Russian pilots are right now gearing up to fly combat missions alongside the Syrian Air Force, dropping bombs on ISIS and on other anti-Assad rebels. And then there was another report that said a Russian warship, part of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, passed through the Bosphorus Strait, right there next to Istanbul, on its way to Tartus, where Russia has its port. And this ship was apparently loaded up with Kamaz trucks and at least four BTR infantry fighting vehicles. So it's some really heavy artillery and some very significant developments there.
Any idea why Russia would be doing this now? I mean, the civil war has been going on for 3 years or more, and we've been talking about just the possibility or the probability of Assad falling all this time. And a lot of people just think, well, how is he still hanging on to power? What is it that suddenly Russia says, we've got to step up our activity to ensure that he stays in power now?
I wonder if part of the reason why Russia is really bolstering its presence now is in part because of the desperation that Europe is feeling. We talked about Mr. McDonald's article and just about how unsolvable this whole crisis is. And if Russia sees that the powers, Germany and the U.S. and others, are getting desperate for a solution, Russia may say, wow, this could very well mean that they could really increase their support for some of these anti-Assad rebels and try to topple Assad. And so it may be because of this, just the heating up climate of all of it, that Russia is taking some preemptive measures to say, oh, no, you don't. You will not topple Assad. We're in here right now. And so that's just one of the main reasons why this conflict is so utterly unsolvable. Before, you know, people would say, you know what, let's just help these rebels topple Assad. Maybe the war will die down. And then maybe this whole immigration crisis will come to an end and whatnot. But now with Russia there, that could be starting World War III. I mean, there is a lot of U.S. support already for some of the anti-Assad Islamists. And so if you have Russia supporting Assad, that's some are saying this is already becoming a proxy war between the United States and Russia because of their support for the conflicting groups there.
They must be calculating that the threat to Assad is greater than it's ever been.
I believe they are. Yes. And I spoke with a journalist yesterday named Levant Kamal. He's just returned to his home in Turkey from Syria. He spent several weeks there in Syria in the cities of Zabadani and Latakia. And Kamal has photographed Russian troops and armored personnel carriers in those cities. And his photos are actually featured in the Telegraph article that we publish in the Trumpet Weekly this week. And his photos are being circulated widely on social media. And on social media, there's a lot of, if this is true, then it's huge kind of rhetoric. But Mr. Kamal told me that there's no question as to whether or not it's true. He has seen the Russian presence rapidly growing in Syria, and it's becoming a lot more active. And he's taken these photos and also videos that show Russians speaking Russian. So that's really compelling evidence that Russia has embedded its troops in the Syrian army. And Kamal said that he would like to collaborate with the Trumpet on a story about this in the next few days. So I hope that our listeners will stop by thetrumpet.com next week and see what we put together for that.
Well, let's turn now to Brent. More of a look at what else is happening in the Middle East that's kind of tying in with this story as well.
Well, if I could, before we get there, I would like to just comment a little bit on what Jeremiah was talking about, because the angle that Russia is scared of losing its naval ports there is huge. We know that they've got their Black Sea port in the Black Sea there. But you've got Turkey that controls the straits out of the Black Sea. So if they're going to have access to the Mediterranean Sea, they need either to be assured that Turkey would not close the straits on them, or they have another base in the Mediterranean already. And Turkey lately has been looking like it's tending towards Europe, talking about how it's a founding or how it's a NATO member. So they might be somewhat threatened in that regard. And I think it also testifies, like you were saying, how absolutely vulnerable the Assad regime is. Last month, you had the leader of the Quds Force, Qassem Soleimani of Iran, he went to Moscow to visit with Vladimir Putin. Now, there was a big uproar through a lot of different people saying, well, this guy's on your list of sanctions, United States. He's not allowed to travel out of the country. Did he travel? And the United States went back and forth and said, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But this action, it looks like, was partly motivated by that. Iran saw that Assad's regime is in danger of falling. They needed some help. They sent their leader, really, of their Quds Force up there. And next thing you know, we've got reports of Russian boots on the ground inside Syria. So Russia needs this. Iran needs Syria to stay under Assad. And then you do have this, the regions that the Islamic State and the Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in northern Syria right now, are pushing hard on that province of Latakia right now. So that's their goal. They're not trying for Damascus as much as they are for trying to rid Assad's reign on the Mediterranean coast. So there's big political moves going on here, big geopolitical moves in all these countries.
You also just have to wonder how much just Russia's increased confidence in its ability to put its military into play without repercussions from the West also factors in, because they've had some pretty impressive victories over the last few years, and maybe they're at a point now where they feel like, hey, we can do it, and there's not going to be any consequences for it.
Right. Well, who do they have to come up against them? Europe is probably not going to act. They're a big behemoth of a bunch of nations. Are they going to go into Syria? Probably not. The United States had their golden opportunity to go in Syria when they drew the red line and said, if chemical weapons are used, we're going in there and we're going to, you know, put a stop to Assad's regime. What did you have then? 2 years ago, the United States works out a deal with Moscow, with Russia, for the Russians to take out the chemical weapons of Assad so that the United States doesn't go in there. So already from back then, they've been working the West over. And even now, it looks like the United States would be happy to at least accept Assad in a transitional government they're talking about before we get to new elections. Anyway, that's one of the headline stories I have. At the top, we have today Putin did announce that Assad is actually going to call for early elections. There is due to be an election in 2016 in Syria, but Putin said Assad is willing to, of course, he'll be a contender in the elections in 2016 as well, but he'd be ready to have those elections. Another just news headline, the You Stink protests in Lebanon have not gone away. Now, it's got a funny name, but it's a play on words. They've got a huge trash crisis where a couple of their landfills are not being used, and trash is piling up in Beirut. And there's a lot of people unhappy about that, but they're using that and then applying it to the political scene as well inside Lebanon, and saying that we're calling for a new political order in Lebanon, something that's been the same since 2006 when Hezbollah really did take over the government there. And you've got a popular movement like we haven't seen since the Arab Spring a couple of years ago that spread all through the Middle East. And some commentators are saying the Arab Spring has finally reached Lebanon. So I'll be watching that over the next couple of weeks to see if that does fan out even more.
All right, the big story from the Middle East.
The big story from the Middle East. It's a very important article. We probably don't have too much time to get into it since I've talked about other things. But it's called, it's by Carolyn Glick, a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, somebody that we follow closely, a great thinker. And she's the article is titled "Our World Losing the War of Ideas." Just the opening sentence says this: "We have arrived at the point where the consequences of the West's intellectual disarmament at the hands of political correctness begins to have disastrous consequences in the lives of hundreds of millions of people." And she goes on to discuss a couple of attacks that have taken place in the United States, terrorist attacks, really, but the inability of the United States government to come out and call it for what it is as part, and what she calls as a holy war, a jihadist war on the West that is spreading through the world, this powerful idea that Islam is king and that we need to take over the world. Now, that presents itself in different people's minds of what they're going to do to accomplish that, but there is a strong element that believe that involves war. And she's saying, since we can't even recognize the problem for what it is, how are we going to fight it? How are we going to attack it? And in that article, she cites just a couple of examples of the Islamic State And how, in one instance, she mentions Egypt and how the Islamic State this week, they put out the offer to the Muslim Brotherhood inside Egypt to join forces and actually combine under their caliphate, growing caliphate. And if this happens, she goes into, this could really make Egypt a more combustible place than it already is. And then she talks about how the Islamic State is also, their popularity is strengthening in a certain province of Pakistan, right on the other side of the Middle East. And that's important because, as she talks about, I think it was the Carnegie Foundation that came out with a study that said that in 5 to 10 years, Pakistan is going to become the number three nuclear power in the world. And they're going to, the place in which they are developing these nuclear weapons is the very place that the Islamic State terrorists are growing in popularity. So while she doesn't say that the Islamic State's going to get a nuclear weapon, she says this cancerous spread of this idea is growing throughout the Middle East, and you've got different Islamist groups that are lining up to join Baghdadi's Islamic State.
The response of the people in the West, kind of still treating the Islamic State like this is a JV squad, we don't really have to worry about this, and the idea that, you know, fundamentally, this is something that's going to kind of burn itself out. That's really the danger here, that this could explode into something far more serious than what they're acknowledging.
Right, exactly. You had the Australian Foreign Minister also come out and say that they might have a dirty bomb already. There was other instances where they have used chlorine gas and attacks in Syria, and then two instances where they've probably used mustard gas as well, chemical agents that have been, well, mustard gas at least has been banned since the First World War. And you'd expect, you know, the West to act on something like this. What would it take for the West to act on the Islamic State more powerfully? Russia seems willing to go in there, but what would it take for America to act? Where's the will?
This section in this article talking about this Carnegie report, Pakistan's nuclear activity being four times what it is in India, and the fact that they're building so quickly. When Pakistan got the bomb, we were talking about just the danger of an Islamic bomb, that this, and the instability in Pakistan, and the fact that it was right there on Afghanistan's border, and the political instability within Pakistan. Now with this in this province in Pakistan, having that much sympathy for the aims of the Islamic State and the fact that that's where the nukes are, it really is concerning. And you could see this developing into something far more serious. You know, it'll be interesting to watch how this happens. Obviously, our view is that Iran is going to be the preeminent power that comes out of the region. This is just more agitation that gives Iran the opportunity to step up and say, well, somebody has to deal with this. You have calls of people in the West saying this is the big reason why we need to empower Iran, because they're the only ones who are willing to fight the Islamic State.
And they're right. You know, Iran is what's the lesser of two evils? Is Russia in the Middle East better than the Islamic State taking over? Probably in the short term. Is Iran putting down the Islamic State a good thing? Maybe in the short term. But these powers, they have greater ideas than even what the Islamic State has eventually.
Well, thank you very much, Brent. We're going to turn now to Robert and the news from Anglo-America. First, the overview, Robert.
The University of Tennessee is ditching gender pronouns. According to the university, students and staff are being asked to ditch the he and she to make the campus more gender neutral. So instead, the school's Office for Diversity and Inclusion wants everyone on campus to use the all-inclusive words like Z or Zim or Zers to make it easier to include all genders. So you might be confused because you might have thought that there were only two genders in human biology, you know, male and female, but not so according to the University of Tennessee.
All right, very good. Sure. What was the top story that you wanted to talk about this week?
Well, the big story this week from America was that the Environmental Protection Agency just had its massive power grab smashed down by a federal judge on August 27th. If you recall, the EPA recently said that it had been studying the Navigable Waters Act, and it had discovered that actually it has far greater jurisdiction than it had ever realized. So now the EPA is saying that not only does it have authority over bodies of water that are large enough to transport goods by boat, but it has the authority to regulate streams and ditches and gullies and swamps and even seasonal waters that could potentially feed into any navigable waterway. And in addition, plus 4,000 feet of land in any direction from any such culvert or wash or mud flat or seasonal marsh in existence. So basically the EPA is now claiming additional hundreds of millions of acres of private and public land that it says is under its jurisdiction. And immediately more than half the states in the union challenged this. Dozens and dozens of business groups challenged it. And then on August 27th, federal judge Ralph Erickson heard the petition of 13 states that had banded together, and he delivered a pretty stinging rebuke of the EPA. He said that, quote, the EPA had violated its congressional grant of authority. He also found that the states have, quote, demonstrated that they will face irreparable harm in the absence of a preliminary injunction. So he ruled against the EPA, and he said that once the EPA's rule takes effect, the states will lose their sovereignty over interstate waters that will then be subject to the scope of the Clean Water Act. So he slapped it down pretty hard, saying, no, you can't implement this law. But what I find really interesting is how the EPA reacted to this ruling. The Hill characterized the response of the EPA and Obama administration this way. It said, in a statement shortly after the ruling, the EPA was defiant and said that the injunction only applies to the 13 states that filed for it. In all other respects, the rule is effective on August 28th, it said. So it's pushing ahead with this rule, even though the judge said, hey, look, this is unconstitutional what you were doing. You're taking away states' rights. And the EPA says, we don't care. We'll hold off for now in those 13 states, but we're pushing it through everywhere else in the country. And this is just the latest example of the lawlessness, this trend of lawlessness we are seeing in government agencies recently. And we're seeing how the EPA has just become really an arm of radical activists, environmental extremist groups. And we're seeing how appointed bureaucrats are now creating law and usurping the role of Congress in a way that hasn't been done in the past.
Stephen Fleury talked about this beautifully on the Trumpet Daily this morning about how selective the government is about applying law when it works in its favor and not applying it when it doesn't like the law, and extending the reach of a law if it feels like it serves its own interests. And you see so many examples of this and the way that they're thinking and using the law as a weapon rather than just applying it the way that they're supposed to. It's an extremely dangerous trend. We've talked a lot about it over the last several years, and you just see these instances more and more unfolding where you see the tremendous radical implications of the way that they're treating the law, throwing out the rule of law, applying it selectively, and basically governing the country the way that a tyrant would. Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. The article that Rob was just talking about, he wrote it himself. It's up on thetrumpet.com, and it's in this week's Trumpet Weekly, this free news report that we produce each week. You can get a free subscription to it at thetrumpet.com. All the stories that we're talking about are in there. We're going to finish up the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll begin with Brent.
Well, Qassem Soleimani, the man I was speaking about previously, the commander of Iran's Quds Force, gave a speech in Iran on September 1st. And people commented on that, or reporters commented on his speech, and these are a few of the things he said. He said the collapse of American power in the region has happened. He gave the factors for this collapse, and one of the most influential reasons for it is the strong logic of the Islamic Republic of Iran in various arenas. Then another of the newspapers in Iran took what he was saying and led with the headline, "The collapse of American power in the region has happened." That's what Iran is thinking on the heels of the nuclear deal.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to Richard.
Scotland is in the news for some interesting poll results that have come from there. There is a survey from Ipso Mori that found that 53% of people in Scotland said they would vote yes to a referendum. Now, Scotland had the referendum last year, and a lot of people, including myself, hoped that this would put the whole issue to bed and that we'd be able to move on from here. But it looks like that's very much not the case now. Most people are saying they would vote yes. And then another poll shows that there would be a Scottish National Party landslide at next year's Scottish Parliament elections. So Scottish nationalism is still here, and it's still going to play a big role in British politics.
All right, we'll move on now to Jeremiah.
Five Chinese Navy ships, including three combat ships, are currently operating off the coast of Alaska. This is the first time they've ever been spotted in that area, and it's a really provocative move. Analysts say that it's no coincidence that China sent these ships there while U.S. President Barack Obama was visiting Alaska. And this confrontational operation took place just as China was hosting a massive World War II Victory Day parade, just sort of showcasing its mushrooming military strength. And the message from China to the U.S. with this parade and with this naval operation seems to just be, we are powerful, we do what we want, we're not afraid of America, get used to it.
All right, we'll turn now to Robert.
So the New York Times is reporting on how much foreign pressure was brought on U.S. members of Congress and the Senate to approve the recent Iran deal. It talked about how senior diplomats from Britain and France and Germany and Russia, how they delivered a blunt joint message to America, that message being that the nuclear agreement with Iran was the best that they could expect and that they had no intention of returning to the negotiating table. Basically, the New York Times is saying that American politicians caved to pressure from the Chinese and Russians mostly, and the others as well, even though that they knew that this was a pretty crummy deal. Opponents of the agreement have said that they could not remember a recent policy battle where the White House and Ms. Pelosi were so driven in tandem and how they worked so hard to make the Iran vote a test of party loyalty. So there's incredible pressure on the members of the Congress and Senate to vote this thing through. One thing that I found interesting about this, Senator Lankford visited Edmond, Oklahoma fairly recently, and he talked about this deal, and he said that this whole idea that the world would rather trade with Iran than the United States, or this idea that the world would not support sanctions, American sanctions on Iran, he did not believe that. He said that if you look at this world, the world can either choose to trade with Iran, who makes up 1% of the world's GDP, or it can trade with America, that makes up more than 25% of the world's GDP. And he said that issue had really been blown out of proportion in his estimation.
So these foreign diplomats that were pressuring these Democrats in Congress, how much leverage do they have? Is this a matter of these Democrats just almost looking for a reason to cave? Or it's basically what you're saying is that they could have stopped it. They could have these Russians and Chinese that said, hey, look, it doesn't matter what the United States does. You guys, if you vote down this deal, we're going to go ahead and do this with Iran anyway. You're saying just looked at from an economic standpoint, the United States still has quite a bit of leverage, but it's squandering it. It's not using it.
Huge amount of leverage. The sanctions that are in place basically said that any business that wanted to do business with Iran in the world, they're free to do that. You just can't do business with an American company. If you're going to do business with Iran, you can't do business with us. And those sanctions were very effective. Even Russian companies towed the line on those sanctions because they wanted to do business in America. Those are the sanctions that with this Iran deal that will be lifted. It's America basically lifting our own sanctions so the world can go ahead and do business with Iran and still do business with America. So as Lankford brought up, the question is, if we want these sanctions to stick, if we want to go back to the negotiating table, we have all the leverage we need to do that because the world wants to do business with America much more than it does with Iran.
So this idea that, say, Russians and Chinese, that they would say, look, and basically, if you're going to undo this deal. We're going to make Iran our trading partner rather than you. That's essentially, if, assuming the United States actually stuck to its guns and said, okay, if you trade, we're not going to do business in any, you know, obviously there's a lot of pressure to get this deal done. But the United States, if it stuck to its guns, then they could do that. And for these other nations to say, we're going to trade with Iran and not with the United States, that would take a lot of guts on their part to do that. But essentially, that's what the New York Times is saying, that that's what's happened.
Right. That's the excuse that they basically given to the politicians in America, so that they have, you know, plausible deniability when they voted for this deal.
All the United States has to do is call their bluff and say, oh, sure, go ahead. We will nuke this deal if we, you know, these Democrats have decided they're going to ahead and do with it, despite huge opposition among Congress, huge opposition among the American people. But they're not willing to do that.
Absolutely. And for some of those reasons we saw, there is a big contingent even in America that wants this deal, an economic contingent. Businesses, they want to get into Iran and do business. And as Stephen Fleury brought out in his Trumpet Daily earlier this week, that there's a lot of money that's flowing into the coffers of these politicians from companies giving donations, same companies that want to do business in Iran. So it makes you a little suspicious as to what's motivating some of the actors that are voting for this deal.
Well, I wanted to just talk a little bit about a county clerk who's sitting in jail right now in Kentucky. This woman who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Yesterday, a federal judge said, you're going to jail for contempt of court because she's not applying the law of the land, which now says that she is to issue licenses to same-sex couples. And suddenly the big point of the same-sex marriage brigade is, this is a nation of laws. We must apply the rule of law. You can't have people deciding which laws to apply and which laws to ignore. The same law applies to everybody right across the board. That's the way it's... Oh, this is a founding principle of the United States, which is just phenomenal. After all that they have done in selectively applying laws, we were talking about it with respect to the EPA earlier in the program, and you see case after case after case where they're willing to throw laws out because they don't like them. Well, now all of a sudden they've discovered the sanctity of this founding principle of the United States. You must have the rule of law. This morning, I found myself over breakfast explaining to my children why there's a county clerk in jail for holding fast to her belief that marriage is between a man and a woman. If you haven't listened to it, I strongly encourage you to listen to Stephen Fleury's Trumpet Daily radio show from this morning where he talked about this. He played clips from our president, clips from the Democratic frontrunner in the presidential race from just a few years ago where they were saying, my personal belief is that marriage is between a man and a woman, and I would take umbrage at anyone who would question my belief in this my belief in this institution, which has been this way since, you know, the mists of antiquity, and how quickly this has changed. And this whole issue has just come on the United States like a freight train. And who was it that was just talking about we have to refer to each other as Zims and Zs? It's just amazing how quickly this has changed. But I do encourage you to listen to that program by Stephen Fleury. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. I would encourage you to get a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about on the program today and many, many more are in this week's report. You can send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. We're also on Twitter, on Facebook, on Google+. Look for us on there. Thanks to our panel, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley. Thanks, gentlemen.
No worries.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
No worries. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Franklin Pierce Jones. You can learn many things from children. How much patience you have, for instance. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.